Session number 16741.
Commander Scott Garrett, Regal 3.
Yes, this Arab guide didn't inspire enormous confidence, and I subsequently learned that they reckoned that he wasn't entirely reliable. Anyway, he managed to take a long time to guide us to this fort, and then we had to descend from the Jebel down onto the plain and onto this causeway. Well, we were in terrible trouble then. It was so difficult, and the route was so tortuous that we had to, in fact, switch lights on, which was not a very clever thing to do, because there's no doubt the lights must have been seen from the enemy side descending these hills. But we had an awful job getting the vehicles down, especially the three tunners. And finally, we managed to get down onto the flat ground and pick up the causeway. I think it was subsequently established that this wretched guide had, in fact, had lost his way. And so we'd gone much further than we needed to, a much more complicated route. Result was we were very, very late. We should have been approaching Benghazi when the RAF raid bombers departed round about midnight. As it was, it was getting on for 4 o'clock in the morning by the time we approached, and we made quite good progress over to this metalled road, and finally we came up on the outskirts of Benghazi, as it turned out, to a bar across the road, a toll gate, and this is when the famous episode took place, because one of the SAS officers, a great character, got out of the leading jeep and went up to this bar to lift it, one of these swinging bars, and said, "Let battle commence." These are words that have gone down in history. And he lifted the bar, and battle did commence.
Did you hear him say it?
Oh, yes. And a moment later, all hell broke loose all around us. We were surrounded in an ambush. The causeway was slightly above the level of the surrounding plain, and obviously down below, sort of concealed in the ditches either side, were enemy soldiers, and it wasn't very nice sitting on a pile of bombs and mines in this three-tonner. So we had the awful job of turning round then, because it was quite obvious there was no point in going on. We were trapped and our whereabouts known. There was no surprise. So we had this awful business. I well remember this terrible business of turning this great convoy. I mean, what must be 40 vehicles, I suppose, round on this causeway and going back under fire. And the amazing thing is, actually, we got very few casualties, actually. I don't know why. I think perhaps they were Italian soldiers, and they weren't all that keen to reveal their position. I remember I had a revolver. I remember emptying my revolver into the darkness, you know. It was a futile attempt. And of course, all the Vickers K machine guns were firing away like mad. It was quite a sort of mayhem, really. And we managed to turn round and start going back. And then, of course, it got light, and we were left on this plain, streaking back towards the safety of the Jebel. And we were all spread out, actually. We were away from this road and spread out across country. And there were vehicles all over the place roaring along. And I remember suddenly there was a buzzing in the sky, and there were some fighter aircraft came in, and they started machine gunning vehicles as they were. You know, you could see a vehicle in the distance there, and there'll be an aircraft diving on it. Next thing, the vehicle was in flames. And there were quite a lot of vehicles were shot up. And amazingly, there weren't all that number of casualties, but there were quite a few. We finally got back to the safety of a wadi, and I remember we actually, there was a sort of cave in this wadi. I remember crawling into this cave, actually, and quite a number of us got in there. One of them was Corporal MacLeod, of a Scots Guard, and he was quite a character, and he's been mentioned in the literature, I notice. He'd been very badly wounded in the arm, and was in terrible pain, and sort of shell dressing on it. And I well remember, for some reason, he seemed to think the Navy would treat him, you know, and they had great respect for us. I don't know why, but of course we weren't any better at first aid than anybody else, but he seemed very keen. I know one of our petty officers, in fact, did actually dress his wound and everything. He was very grateful. It always stuck in my mind, that incident about the faith of this army in the naval element in our midst. Anyway, we were all scattered, of course. The whole force was scattered along this escarpment, taking shelter. And I always remember next door to us was one of the Free French, and aircraft were coming over and sort of trying to hunt us out. And somebody said, the Free French were all sitting in their truck actually, with their Vickers K guns pointing up. And somebody said, for God's sake, don't shoot, don't shoot. And of course they opened up on an aircraft, you see. And this gave us away, gave us away completely. And of course, the silly idiots, of course, they were very, very versatile, very mercurial, these French. Their officer was an extraordinary individual. He was an American, actually, a real sort of daredevil type, you know. But American captain. Anyway, we managed to survive most of these attacks, and then we started making our way back across. I don't know what happened to my truck, actually, and the rest of the party. I found myself with some other chaps. We had a jeep, actually, and compared undamaged jeep, and we drove along the general direction of the main rendezvous, which of course we didn't really know where it was, but we drove quite a while, and then the poor old jeep, the engine collapsed for lack of oil. It had a bump on the sump, and all the oil leaked out. And I suddenly thought of some bit of engineering I remembered from my training, that you could make a fairly reasonable lubricant by using soap and water. So we managed to get some water out of the radiator and mix up some soap we were carrying, and poured it into the sump, and we got about another 10 miles out of it, which was quite something. And that night, by then it was dark, and we had to bed down for the night. And all we had actually was a camouflage net. It was very, very cold. It was surprisingly cold in the desert at night. It got very, very cold indeed. I always remember sort of cowering under this camouflage net, which didn't give much protection, much warmth. And so there we were, and off we went again in the morning. And we were walking by then. And I remember Major Sterling, David Sterling, came striding by. And it was very, very cheerful, he was, even though we were obviously in full retreat. He said, oh yes, well that's the way, along this way, you know. Off he went again. And we struggled on. And finally, I think we came across a Senussi. Of course, the Senussi were the local inhabitants. Lived in this area. And they didn't move out for the war. They just went on living there, and the war went all around them, Senussi Arabs. And they were very much on our side, actually, because they'd had experience of the Italians before the war, who didn't give them much encouragement, and had a nasty habit of if they had disagreement with the Senussi village, they used to take up the headman in one of their aircraft and drop him onto the village just to sort of encourage the others. So the Senussi were very, very much on our side, and one could trust them. And they were very fine, interesting people, actually. I mean, they were. I remember having quite a conversation with this Senussi and exchanging words in various languages. And I had my map, and I was pointing out my map and everything, and he was very interested. And he knew where we were, actually, where our rendezvous were. He actually guided us back to it. And we arrived round about, I think I was about midday or so. No, we arrived later, that's right. And the... Yes, we arrived and... No, we must have arrived quite early. I think we arrived round... And I think I had a wonderful breakfast there, that's right.
Arrived where?
Back at the rendezvous, where we actually started from, where we'd left all the vehicles we didn't take on the raid. So our base camp, in fact, in the base wadi. And so by then, there were aircraft circling around, buzzing around, and we were told taking cover and everything. And it was fairly obvious they knew where we were, and they disappeared. And then round about midday, suddenly there was a noise of quite heavy aircraft. And I can remember this to this day, looking up the wadi, and there were three Savoy bombers, so wingtip to wingtip, flying straight down this wadi with everything going, guns, bombs, a lot. And they were so low that the bombs they dropped didn't explode, fortunately, and they went roaring up. And then waves and waves of aircraft came at us in every direction. I put down the mix. There were a whole variety of them, actually. There were Messerschmitts 109s, there were Mackie 202s, CR-42s, a whole variety of aircraft. Mainly, I think, they were Italian manned, fortunately. The Savoy bombers, of course, were Italians. And they just kept attack all day long. And we all scattered as much as we could, obviously away from the vehicles and things, which was the target. And I remember getting quite some distance away, and I was under a little bush, a little sort of gorse-type bush. It was only about 6 feet high, and I was under there with another chap. And eventually, one of the Italian prisoners, these two prisoners we had, one of them arrived, and he was absolutely, I've never seen anybody quite so frightened in all my life. He was literally green with fear. And I don't know, he seemed to think that we could sort of help him in some way. I remember he offered me his coat, his jacket, if I would do something. I don't know what he expected me to do, but he was terribly frightened, there's no doubt about it. Anyway, he lay in the shadow of this bush, because there's no doubt if you ran across the desert, and an aircraft would spot you at once. They're definitely machine gun people who are actually moved at all. So the thing was to stay absolutely still, which took some doing, especially when you saw an aircraft bearing down towards you, firing away, and the shell cases were actually dropping all over the hot cartridges. And this went on all day long, right until dusk. And they got most of our vehicles, and I think there were three killed and quite a number wounded. And I also remember the Sergeant Major, who was a great character. He'd been at Dunkirk, and he said, "You know, this is worse than being on the beaches at Dunkirk." So, it certainly wasn't very nice. I must say, it was a hell of a day, actually. Anyway, it ended, and darkness came down, and we had all this regrouping, vehicles on fire. All tires were burnt. You see, we had a terrible job. We had to salvage what vehicles we could. And it was an awful lot of wheel-changing vehicles that were damaged otherwise and had sound tires. We had to take the wheels off and everything. And we had some of the casualties from the earlier raid on the fort. We were in a Red Cross tent. And they had been further injured. I mean, they had fired on the Red Cross, and you know, it was all very nasty. But we regrouped and were all set to move off. And I also remember one incident. We had a. That's right. One of the Free French came along. And he said he wanted a creek. And I couldn't understand what a creek was. And finally, somebody wanted a jack, because they wanted to jack up their vehicle and change the wheels around, you see. So we lent him this jack, and off he went. And lo and behold, he came back later on with the jack to give it back to us, which was very nice of him, I thought. And of course, then he went back, and his chums had pushed off, you know. So he had to come back with us. We all piled onto a truck, including this lone Frenchman, and off we went. And it was fairly hair-raising, because our truck had its wheels changed, that's right. But the brake drum, the brake box had burnt, actually, so we had very, very minimal brakes, actually. So any descent was very alarming, actually, with no brakes at all. But off we went, and we got away from our base wadi and got back into the hinterland and travelled as far as we could. And then we lay up for another day. And I think it was this day that we actually entered a bit of country where it was rather a flat sort of desert with much cover, but there were quite a number of underground wells, the sort of cisterns they call them, had been dug into the desert. And they were dry. You nip down to these. It was like being in a sort of air raid shelter. So I remember we spent a large part of the day sitting in one of these things. But then the aircraft buzzed around, but they never actually found us again, actually, which was a great help. Then our next difficulty was to get past this Jalo Oasis, which the SDF were besieging. They hadn't actually taken it. They were sort of besieging it. And we arrived, and you could just see the oasis vaguely in the distance. And we sent a couple of our jeeps in to contact our besieging forces. What actually had happened was that we'd got half the oasis, and the Italians were in the other half. And it was a very sort of gentlemanly war they were fighting. They more or less agreed to cease hostile actions at lunchtime. And so every afternoon there was a siesta on both sides. And then they sort of, you know, they'd start up the next day and have a bit of shelling and everything. Anyway, the answer was, of course, that we could get our convoys passed without any trouble. And so we did. And then we went straight down again, following our original track. And got to an oasis called Zigain, which was on the edge of the Sand Sea, that's right. And we went across the Sand Sea, and Zigain was a bit further on. It's actually not really off Kufra. And we arrived there, and the Sudan Defense Force were there, and they were very helpful, because by then we had trouble with our vehicles and everything, and they helped us, and they gave us food and everything. And another day or so, and we arrived back in Kufra, the main oasis. And that was really the end of the operation. As a matter of interest, the other attacks which were made on the airfields were very successful. One of the airfields, they destroyed about 35 planes, I think, on the airfield. I think it was Barche Airfield. The main attack on Tobruk was a complete failure. And it was a very tragic failure, because, I mean, there was attack was being mounted both from the land, and also the Navy were also bombarding from the sea. And we had a lot of casualties. We lost, I think, we lost several destroyers, and all the men who attacked Benghazi were captured, including all the soldiers dressed up as Germans. So the Tobruk raid really was rather a failure.
Coming back to your own party, can you remember the names of any of the others who were in the naval party with you?
I know one of the deck officers was called Halliday, Lieutenant Halliday. I can't, for the life of me, I can't remember the other ones. I can't remember the ratings names.
Can you remember the backgrounds of any of them or what they were like?
They were R&VR, I think. They weren't regular Navy. I was the only regular Navy or Naval officer actually on that. I can't remember the backgrounds at all. Oddly enough, that book, which is Galloping Major, which is about Colonel Sterling, David Sterling, lists all the army, all the SAS officers, and doesn't list any of the Navy at all.
What did you feel like once you got back to Kufra?
I don't know, really. I suppose I felt disappointed because we had all sorts of ideas. We thought we might be lucky, and after we'd done our task in Benghazi harbour, we might be able to seize an Italian destroyer and steam it back to Alexandria. That was Jolly Jack was all for doing that. You know, it would have been a wonderful experience, but it wasn't to be, I'm afraid. No, I don't know, really. I suppose I felt I'd taken part in something very, very interesting, and that I'd always remember it as being the sort of one of the great episodes in my life. It was an astonishing experience. You know, an engineer officer who normally spent his time in action down in an engine room never saw anything at all. I suddenly found myself careering across the desert, meeting these extraordinarily interesting people. It didn't actually finish with it at Kufra, because after a few days there, they decided to evacuate us on a convoy of one of these big supply convoys running across the desert to Wadi Halfa in the Sudan. And they had these very large American Mack trucks. And while we were there, there was a raid on Kufra by Junkers 88s. Three Junkers 88s bombed Kufra. Without achieving very much, and one of them got shot down. And as luck would have it, they for some extraordinary reason, decided to send the tailplane of this Junkers 88 back to Egypt. I don't know why. So it was chopped off and loaded onto one of the Mack trucks, and the truck I was travelling on, in fact, plus the crew who bailed out. So I travelled back across the desert, it took us about a week, I suppose, to get back to Wadi Halfa, in this big convoy of, I suppose, about half a dozen of these great big trucks. And I travelled back on this truck with the tailplane of the Junkers 88 and a German sergeant and two corporals.
What was their demeanour and attitude?
They were great chaps, actually, apart from one of the corporals, who was a Nazi. There's no doubt he was a Nazi. And the sergeant, who was a regular Luftwaffe pilot, and the other corporal, they didn't like this chap very much because he was a sort of Nazi. they regarded him as not quite one of them. They were extremely nice and interesting chaps. I spent a lot of time with them, talking to them. Well, I couldn't do much else, really, and we used to play bridge in the evenings, and we stopped at night, and I compared notes with them, and they'd undoubtedly bombed my ship, the Aralis, in the Mediterranean, several occasions, because we compared notes and dates. They also said it was an absolute picnic compared to Russia, because they'd been on the Russian front, and they'd come to the Mediterranean, and it was very, very different. So, it was a very enjoyable period, actually. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I even drove this magnificent Mack truck, which had five gears and two ratios. So when you change gear, you started off in one low, and then you changed to one high, and then to two low. In fact, you had your co-driver had to change one lever while you changed the other. You could even go in reverse by changing gear in reverse from low to high, which is the most amazing. They were fantastic things, enormous American trucks. And I always remember asking the these Germans what they thought of the Italians. And they said, well, what do you think of the Egyptians? They had no time for the Italians at all, their allies. Yes, and then the last sighting I remember was, it was in a train, an Egyptian train, where we were going back down the Nile Valley. And I saw them looking out of the window at all this milling throng around. I could see their faces, you know. They were very reasonable chaps. I can't complain about those men at all. We got back to Wadi Halfa, and then I was able to get into the Nile Hotel, which was an absolute heaven, of course. Get a room there, and I remember I had a local Egyptian barber came along and shaved me, because by then I had quite a long beard. And cut my hair, and of course had baths and everything, and civilized meals. It was absolutely wonderful after all these weeks in the desert. And then we went down by river steamer. And the army had ran these steamers up and down the Nile. And we went right down. I remember seeing, looking across at Abu Simbel, the great figures on the side of the gorge. And finally we got to Aswan, where we landed. And we then went down by train to Cairo, where I reported, I think, to the advisors of the army, I suppose, then. I was still under the army. And finally we went back to Cabret, the SAS headquarters, and sort of collected our gear, and then back to HMS Saunders next door, and came under the Navy again, and I think I then went back to Alexandria, and finally I rejoined my ship.